Hey everyone, I'm Yasmin Noori and you're listening to the Behind Her Empire podcast. I'm on a mission to showcase successful self-made women who share honest stories and lessons of what it really takes to create the life you want and build your own empire. If you've been listening to the show, you know, just like you, I've been on my own personal journey to build my empire. I started my business Bia to help women tackle their period problems and hormonal imbalances using a natural whole foods approach. If you're suffering from bad cramps, irregular periods, fatigue, bloating, stay tuned because a little bit later in the podcast, I'll share a bit more about my company, Bia. But for now, let's jump into today's episode. I want to welcome this week's guest, Sarah Murray, to our show today. Sarah is the founder and CEO of Curie, a clean deodorant and body care brand on a mission to change the stigma around clean beauty. Sarah has been an athlete all of her life and was a very active person. And one thing she could never come across was a clean aluminum-free deodorant that actually worked and fit her lifestyle. From her own frustration, Sarah decided to start Curie as a side hustle in 2019 to solve her own problem. Sarah then bootstrapped the company and financed it with $20,000 in her savings, and very early on was hitting six figures with content, word of mouth, and PR. Fast forward to today, the company has scaled to be a $20 million success story and is sold in thousands of stores nationwide, including Walmart, Nordstrom, Bloomingdale's, and they've sold out dozens of times through live selling on QVC. Sarah has also appeared on season 13 of Shark Tank and landed a deal with Barbara Corcoran and Mark Cuban. In this week's episode, Sarah talks about her transition from accounting to becoming an entrepreneur, the steps she took to turn her side hustle to a full-time business, and how she had incredible growth with very little money early on. We also talk about the many rejections she faced when it came to finding manufacturers, getting into retailers, and participating in Shark Tank. She shares stories we can't make up and how she turned all those no's into yeses. Sarah also shares her crazy experience on Shark Tank and what really happens behind the scenes that we don't typically see, and so much more. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you. I'm so excited. It was a long time coming.
It was. And I know we first met years ago, and I feel like we both had very different lives back then. Like before entrepreneurship, you were in VC, I was in tech. So we have a lot to talk about today to catch up on all those years.
It's like truly a lifetime ago. Yeah.
And I'm like, who was that?
We've gone like totally different direction. But it's fun to, I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I thought it'd be fun to start with the topic of rejection. You've mentioned it in a few other interviews. And I know you said for the longest time, rejection of Curie felt like rejection of Sarah. And you used to be so scared of failure, rejection, and being told no. And I think so many people listening can 100% resonate with that. I know I can, but I'm sure we'll talk a lot about your rejections. So much of business is dealing with that. So tell me, how did you overcome your own fears and manage the rejection that you face on a constant basis?
Yeah, I love this question. I love talking about this because I think that starting a business is such a vulnerable thing, as is, you know, starting a podcast. Like putting yourself out there, putting your art, your work out there for judgment is really, really scary. And I worked in venture capital before I started Curie. My job was, I was an associate. That's when we met. My job was to find entrepreneurs and to, for the fund that I worked for, to invest in. So I met with hundreds of entrepreneurs. That was my job, was to meet with entrepreneurs every single day. And I think before I got into venture capital, I would look at, you know, Forbes magazine at these entrepreneurs on the cover, like Sarah Blakely, and be like, wow, like she must have something super special that I don't, or that nobody has. And these, I kind of put these entrepreneurs on a pedestal. And what was a really, I think, important part of this job for working in venture capital is I got to meet with the entrepreneurs every day. And after meeting with hundreds of them, I realized like there isn't actually anything different, or like these aren't some types of superhumans. Really, all it takes to be an entrepreneur is to have an idea and the guts to go out there and do it. And that's what stops a lot of people from going out and doing it, is the second part, which is the vulnerability and the fears that come with starting something and putting your work out there to the world for scrutiny. And it was a huge aha moment for me where I was like, these people aren't any smarter or more special. They just have the guts to do it. And that's really all it takes. And that really motivated me. I had always wanted to start something of my own. And I was like, I'm going to go, you know what? If all these people can do it, so can I. I'm going to go out there and do it. And as soon as I had an idea that I thought was good enough, I just went out there and did it. And I faced so much fear. I wrote a ton about this back when I was first starting Curie, about just the fears and fear of failure and fear of being like a laughing stock. You know, I was starting a deodorant company and I'd be like, you know, sometimes I'd wake up in the middle of the night and be like, who am I to do this? Like, why would I be successful at this? And really pushing through and conquering those fears has been so key to my success and to where I am today. And also acknowledging that that rejection and fear of failure is never going to stop.
Yeah.
And by just powering through, you get stronger and stronger and stronger. And I was just saying, I think I said this on Shark Tank. I was like, every great thing that has happened in my business has started with a no. QVC said no to me. Shark Tank said no to me. Every retailer we're in has said no to me at some point. And just powering through and not letting those no's and that rejection get you down is, I think, the most important quality for an entrepreneur.
I love that. And there's so many things that you said that definitely hit. You know, one of them being so many people have ideas and it's really taking the guts to make that leap. And I had a similar situation. So when we had met, I think I was working at this tech startup here in LA. And this guy, what the founder was like, his third time entrepreneur, sold his businesses, raised money before we had product market fit. And I remember that was my firsthand experience. And I was sitting there in a room, it was only like five of us at the time. And no one knew what they were doing. And I'm like, wow, this guy who has started businesses, like he doesn't even know the right next step. And it was just a good aha moment of, you just take one step in front of the other and we're all figuring it out, no matter what stage yes. you're in and how yes. big your business is. And similar to you, I was like, oh, so you don't have to be this magical person that starts a company and put them on a
pedestal. Or even like an expert in, like yes. you said, like you don't even have to, I didn't know anything about cosmetics or personal care, but you know what? Now I'm an expert. And like, it just took doing it and learning and being curious and asking questions and networking, and you can become an expert in anything. So I think that's also a limitation people set on themselves is like, I can't do this. Like what business do I have starting a tech company or a personal care company? And I think especially women, whenever I talk to aspiring entrepreneurs, that's a lot of times what I hear is, you know, I'm not qualified enough. Oh, I didn't get a degree in business. Like, therefore, oh, I didn't get an MBA. Therefore, I can't be a CEO. It's like, yeah, you can. Most of the CEOs out there just did it and figured it out, including myself. So I think that's a really great message. It's like, you don't need to know everything. Nobody knows everything. Most people are kind of just figuring out as they go.
And that's like the whole reason I want to do this podcast. I'm like, I have friends, I'm having these conversations, I'm building my own business, but it's not as glamorous. Like, let's have these real conversations, how we're all figuring it out. And also one thing, and this stood out, I was talking to a woman yesterday who was really trying to grow her business. She's like, I have these ideas, but so many people have done it before. And I'm like, but no one is you. You yeah. are unique. Like, even Sarah, I'm sure you've thought that. Like, everyone's like, oh, there's natural deodorants out there.
There's deodorants out there. Exactly. Yeah.
So how did you kind of work through that for yourself? Because it's a narrative that so many people have.
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing I hear a lot is like, oh, I don't have an invention. Like, I don't have anything that I've invented. But like you said, I think it's about one, and this is what I did, which was like, I identified a problem. I wanted a problem that was a problem I had. I didn't want to build a company, and I know a lot of people do, but I didn't want to build a company where I was like solving problems that I didn't myself had. Like, I wanted to be my first customer. And so I was just like, what problems do I have? Like, what do I wish was better? And you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You just have to find something that needs to be improved and find creative and clever ways to improve it. And a lot of inventions are not completely novel. Like, most great companies are just born out of finding that opportunity to fix something that's broken or improve something that could be better.
Yeah.
And putting, like you said, putting your spin on it. And it's really about the person. I did a lot of mentorship. And one of the girls that I mentor was like, you know, protecting her idea and like didn't want to tell anyone her idea because she was afraid they were going to steal it. And I was like, girl, You have to go talk to people and network and share your idea, because the idea is like 20%.
The easiest part,
yeah. The idea is the easiest thing. Yeah. Like, the execution and the people, like, that is what you've got that nobody else has. That's the other 80%. So that's, you know, I think that just goes to show it's not about completely reinventing the wheel. It's that other 80%. It's your spin on things. It's you and the execution that really can create a, you know, a huge business even in a crowded space.
Yeah. And I love that you said finding a problem that you identify with, because finding those tweaks and enhancements, it makes it a little bit easier, I think, at least from my perspective. But before, you know, you were in the world of entrepreneurship from VC and then ultimately starting Curie, you actually had like a quote unquote safe job, right? You went to BU. By the way, I went to BU too. I don't know if we ever talked about that.
I didn't know that.
I studied finance. I think you were accounting. I'm like, we were in the same building. So I'm sure we.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's
small.
Wild.
Small world. But I know, you know, similar to you, I also went down that safe route. So tell me more about what did you envision your life to look like out of college? Because clearly you made a hard left turn and left all the comfort. So where did that kind of come from? And what did you envision your life to be at that time?
Yeah. So that's so interesting that you went to BU, because you'll get this, like, Boston University and especially the School of Management, the business school, was really, it's on the East Coast. So it's very East Coast focused. It's investment banking, it's accounting, it's like banking, like all the like traditional industries and finance. Like, it was a very finance heavy school, especially when it came to like recruiting. And so that was really all I felt exposed to. And I was also in college, you know, during the recession. So graduating, it was really, I've always been a really independent. And the idea of not having a job out of college was like, oh my God, like I would die if I don't have a job out of college. But now in hindsight, I'm like, it's ridiculous. But it was really, really important to me to get a great job out of college, and so I could like financially support myself. And so I was really good at finance and accounting. Still am pretty, you know, pretty good at with numbers, analytical, like financial modeling, all of that. And was really great at accounting specifically. I just found it really interesting. And so got my CPA license, went and worked at PricewaterhouseCoopers and did the whole auditing thing. It was so not the career for me, but it gave me a really great foundation in finance and accounting. And I still use a lot of that, you know, knowledge today. But in terms of leaving that safety, it was really, really difficult. But I knew that there was more out there. Like I talk a lot about the concept of like climbing the wrong mountain. And like, I love this visual of, you know, you're here on this mountain and here over here is this mountain, and climbing the mountain you're higher on the mountain you're on is not going to get closer to the mountain you want to be on. It's just going to get you further. And that visual was like exactly how I felt during my accounting career, where I would look at my boss and my boss's boss, and I was like, I don't want that job. Like, I don't want that job. Or I'd even look at people where, you know, accounting jobs that people would get outside of PwC. And I was like, I don't want any of those jobs.
Yeah.
And so I was climbing the wrong mountain, and I had to take the risk and jump off and go find the right one. And, you know, luckily I did that in my 20s when not a lot was at stake, but it was still scary. And I still had, you know, my family who was, you know, my mom who was like, what? You're quitting this stable career that has benefits and a good salary. But I think I would be miserable if I was still doing that. And I'm really happy with where things turned out. But it was definitely a challenge at the time.
Hey everyone, it's Yasmin here. In 2020, I was struggling with some debilitating health stuff. I just got off birth control and suddenly I had acne, mood swings, breast tenderness, and really painful periods. I tried so many things, but the one thing that worked was something called seed cycling. I know you're probably thinking, seed cycling? What the heck is that? It's a natural way to support your hormones hormones using four specific seeds throughout your cycle. The challenge is that seed cycling can be a little complicated to do and kind of time consuming. So I decided to make an organic seed cycling product that is so easy to use. We make it effortless for anyone to get started today. It's called Bia, and it's a super easy way to add something powerful to your diet to support your hormones, regulate your cycle, and bring back balance. To learn more about Bia and join our community with thousands of incredible women all over the world, go to BiaWellness.com, and that's spelled B-E-E-Y-A wellness.com. And check out the show notes for our promo code to get $10 off your first purchase. Thanks so much for listening. And now let's get back to today's episode. And sometimes it's like being in those jobs that you don't like, that is actually like a beautiful thing. You're like, oh, this is not it for me. And like you jump around. Like I did the whole investment banking thing. Cause again, like you said, on the East Coast, that was, God forbid you don't do one of these tracks. It's like, who are you? What are you doing? So I was following everyone. Props to you to leave earlier. I did it for like 6-7 years. But you know, there's so many gifts of working with different people, understanding what I don't like, what I do like. So I love the just people having different experiences before starting a business, because there's so much that you can bring to the table. And what I actually love about what you mentioned, you know, for you being independent, being in a position to financially support yourself, people might look at you and be like, well, then how did you risk it all to start your company? But you are very methodical about it. You didn't just like quit and start. So let's talk about that, because I think there's a lot of myths when it comes to starting a business. And I don't know if that's always financially the right thing. Of course, everyone is so unique in their situation. But yes, tell me more about how it started and how you managed that risk.
Yeah. And I think first of all, it's like, it's never too late to change your mind. I started my company at 30. Like it was, I think there's so much more time than you think. And I remember being 27, 28 and feeling this pressure to have everything figured out. And I had so much time, and I wish I could go back and tell that version of Sarah, you know, you relax, like things are gonna work out. You've got time to figure things out, and it's okay to zig and zag. But in terms of making that big leap financially, I mean, I started my company. I was 29, almost 30. I was single at the time, and you know, living in San Francisco, and I knew that I couldn't quit my job and just start this little deodorant business because I wasn't there yet financially. So I put most of my savings, $12,000 of my savings, into our inventory and starting the business. So I knew that I was not going to be able to support myself financially and afford rent and, you know, to live. I also just didn't want to put that pressure on the business, you know?
Totally.
I didn't want to raise money, and that's a whole other story. Didn't want to raise money, and I didn't want to put pressure on the business where I was desperate and making maybe not the right choices for our customers because I just needed to make payroll or whatever. So I think in hindsight, like the way I ran the company for the first year and a half, even though it was hard and frustrating and really challenging, it really set the foundation for Curie. It was just me and my sister for that first year and a half. I still had a full-time job the whole time. So Curie was a total side hustle. Nights, weekends, my sister joined when she was on maternity leave with her first baby and took over all the fulfillment and customer support. Because before that, I was trying to juggle it all, and I was traveling for work, and I would have to shut down our store when I would travel because I couldn't, you know, it was a nightmare. So my sister jumped in, and I think I had to go to Tel Aviv for work for 10 days. And I was like, how am I going to do this? And my sister, that was when she stepped in, took over all of our fulfillment, all of our customer support. She still works with me today.
Well, amazing.
And it's been really fun. And so the risk of starting something is one of the biggest challenges. And so I always tell people, if in whatever ways you can mitigate that risk for yourself, do it. It's worth it. Even if you can't invest 100% of your time, you know, you have to work a job to be able to support yourself. It's worth it, so that you're not making choices out of desperation because your livelihood depends on it. Curie could grow as slow as it wanted to because I wasn't dependent on that revenue. So that's always something I recommend, unless you're going and raising, you know, VC funding. If you want to bootstrap, plan to have a job while you're figuring things out and plan to do everything on your own. And I think that was a blessing. You know, doing everything on my own means now I really know my business. So silver lining of having to work insane hours in those early days.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think that what you mentioned about it, we're also, you know, self-funded, and people always ask me like, are you going to raise money? And I'm thinking to myself, that pressure already, like you said, we don't talk enough about. It's like already starting a business with investors or not is already high pressure. So for you to like leave your job and just double down, and listen, so many people do it. Everyone's circumstance is so different. I kind of working in that space, I didn't want that for myself. But yeah, it's like this unnecessary pressure. So if you can keep your job or whatever that is to have that cushion for a little bit, you make the right choices for the customers, the business. So I love that you said that.
Yeah. And I will acknowledge, like, it was also a function of where I was at in my life, where I could work, you know, all day and all night because I was single. I didn't have kids yet. I was really able to work two jobs. Like, I worked full time, and then Curie was another full time job. And I know, though, that that's not always the case. And, you know, if you have kids or a family to support, might be a different circumstance. But for me, where I was at in my life, it was the best decision to really slowly let the business grow organically before I went all in.
Yeah, I know. I love that. And I love that your sister jumped in. I remember when I was once traveling, well, we weren't traveling, and my husband's like, can we go away for the weekend? I'm like, but then how do I ship stuff? Like, I don't have anyone shipping the boxes. And my mom actually, so similar to you, I was like, Mom, can you like send out these orders like very early on, you know? But yeah, these are the things you think about.
I used to, before my sister started helping, I would bring suitcases of deodorant with me on trips with my little label printer and some like shipping envelopes. And I would, you know, I remember going on a business trip to New York, and in my hotel in the morning before the conference, I would pack up all the orders, run them to USPS, and then run to the conference, and then, you know, do it again the next day. I had this like giant deodorant bag that I schlepped with me across the country.
Oh my gosh. I love that. The realities of the behind the scenes. It's so fun. And what I appreciate about you also when you started Curie is that you were super, super scrappy. Like, I think a lot of people spend thousands of dollars on finding a brand agency and like a beautiful website. Like, tell me more about how you approached it being so nimble early on.
Yeah. I mean, especially now, there are so many resources out there. You can find anything on YouTube, Udemy. Like, you can figure anything out. There's tutorials, there's courses, there's blogs. So with all that, all those resources out there, it is easier than ever, I think, to bootstrap if you want to do that. Again, no judgment for anyone that goes out and raises VC funding, but that was just not the way I wanted to start my business. And I love building and figuring things out. And that was exciting to me to like figure all this stuff out on my own. I didn't want to go out and hire some big fancy branding agency. Like, I kind of enjoyed that like scrappiness in the early days. And so I just taught myself, well, I didn't have the cash to, but even if I did, I just taught myself everything. I built a Shopify website in a weekend, like drinking a glass of wine at my kitchen table, and built a website. It's so easy. Anyone can do it. There's tons of templates. I had a friend who had the nice new iPhone at the time that had a good camera, had her come over, took some product photography against like a white wall in my bathroom. Boom, there's my product photography. The packaging, I did a Adobe Illustrator course and learned how to use Adobe Illustrator, designed my packaging myself. I read a bunch of books on marketing and branding and put together taglines and all of that and figure out who my customer was and our social media strategy. So it was fun for me. Like, I personally, I just loved doing it and figuring it all out. I look back and, you know, as you grow, your problems change and things just get more complicated. And I look back on that, those like 6 months so fondly, because it was just like, it was so fun and getting to figuring it all out on my own. And, you know, of course we've changed everything, you know, changed our branding. We eventually
normal.
But it was enough to get us going. And that was the goal. It was like, I'm probably going to change a lot of this stuff. I'm so glad we didn't hire a branding agency at the beginning, because, you know, we didn't know who our customer was yet. And we did a big rebrand about a year in, and I'm really glad that we waited.
Exactly. Yeah. I remember when we launched, people are like, are you going to throw like, do this big splash? And I'm like, I'm just trying to learn along the way. Like even though we were live, I'm like, I kind of think of us still in beta. Like, is this resonating? Are shipments going through? What do customers feel? But you're right. You changed so much of it, even a year in business. So I love the approach you took. So tell me more about the moment you decided to go all in. Like, how were you creating awareness early on, and what made you feel comfortable to put all your eggs into this basket?
So it's actually funny. So I actually decided to quit my job and go all in on Curi in like January of 2020, AKA 2 months before COVID started. And it was terrible, terrible timing. But I'm not sure if anyone follows the deodorant news, but COVID was not kind to the deodorant industry. When the lockdown started, people just stopped buying deodorant, and our sales just fell off a cliff. When the lockdown started, it was really difficult. I quickly pivoted. We launched a hand sanitizer with our like amazing fragrances and made it all natural and like super moisturizing. And we ended up selling like hundreds of thousands of bottles within a few months, and it totally saved the business. But it was terrifying. I was like, woohoo, I'm quitting my job. Shoot. I'm going all in on my startup. And boom, all of our customers disappear. It was a dark time. But, you know, making that decision to go all in for me was partially inspired. Have you ever read Phil Knight's book, the founder of Nike?
No, but many people have brought it up.
Shoe Dog, so it's called.
Yes, Shoe Dog.
It's great. I was at the time commuting for my day job. I was commuting to Palo Alto. And so I was listening to it on audiobook during my commute. And there was this part where he talks about his fear was not failure. It was his fear was wasting time and spending years and years of his time on something that was never going to work out. So he's like, I wasn't scared of failing, but like, if I was going to fail, I just wanted to fail fast and like move on, take those learnings and start something new as quickly as possible. And I remember listening to that and being like, wow, like that's exactly how I feel. And by not going all in on Curi, I would make excuses. I'd be like, oh, we didn't hit our forecast because, you know, I don't have any employees. It's just me. And I have a full-time job. So, you know, imagine if I worked full-time on Curi, we probably would. Like, I would use it as an excuse. And I realized, I think that moment, hearing that, was I was like giving myself an excuse not to succeed. And by not being all in, I was protecting myself if it didn't work out. Fear of failure was such a thing for me that going all in was too scary. Like having Curi just be this side hustle was a lot safer because I could always fall back on the excuse that I, you know,
that's
didn't
true.
Have enough time. So I decided that it was time to go all in. You know, we were making enough money at that point where I could support a mediocre salary. And so I decided to quit my job.
I mean, this is pre-pandemic, but how are you guys creating awareness and selling? Was it like influencers? What was your mode at that time? Because I know you didn't have a lot of money to like spend on ads. So it was just organic?
Yeah. And I mean, it was a different time. So things change so quickly. This might not be as easy these days, but at the time it was really easy Instagram was kind of like how TikTok is now, where if you have good content, like it's pretty easy to go viral. Like you used to be able to go viral on Instagram, and that's not really the case anymore. So Instagram was like a different place. I was constantly on our stories, going on trail runs and doing, you know, sniff tests and be like, oh, I still smell good. And I would do like fun little content series. I would do coffee with customers where customers that lived in San Francisco, I'd grab coffee with them and I would do Instagram live and all that. So I was just doing a lot of social media, a lot of organic social. We grew a following on social pretty quickly. And we started to, you know, get outreach from influencers. I didn't really even know what influencer marketing was at the time. So, you know, influencers started just reaching out and I'd be like, cool, yeah, here's some deodorant. And then they would post about us. And I remember Skinny Confidential posted about us. And
oh, that's amazing.
We did like our biggest sales day ever. And so influencers, but it was mostly unpaid. It was like, hey, you want to try this and maybe post about us. And so influencers, and then I also would reach out to press. I would read articles, find the contact, and then reach out. And we got some really good press in those early years, and press is free. So it was a good use of time. I would once a week reach out to 10 journalists, and we got some really good hits. I think we got in Glamour magazine, Self magazine. So I would say social, organic social, some influencers and press were big in the early days.
And when you're reaching out to press, were you just giving kind of a blurb of the business and like the angle that they would take, or how would you kind of foster those relationships?
Yeah, I had a good friend that worked in PR. So she helped me put together like a great email where we would just talk about, you know, the sizzle reel, the highlights, the business, what we were doing, and then help me think about, you know, a catchy subject line to catch their attention. And it was pretty successful.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a lot of organic outreach. And then also because we were a deodorant and I am super into fitness, I would reach out to fitness studios and be like, hey, we have this aluminum free deodorant. Do you want to offer it for sale? And so we had a bunch of probably like 100 little fitness studios that were carrying Curie, and we would, you know, send them minis for gift bags for events. And so fitness studios were another part of that early strategy. You're just getting the word out, you know?
Yeah, like super grassroots. I love that. But, you know, to build that momentum is amazing. So then COVID hits, obviously, you know, like you told us, no one's buying deodorant. How did you guys pivot a hand sanitizer so soon? Because I mean, I remember those times, like no one was shipping. I was just like hustling to get our product done. So how did you pivot so quickly? Because that truly, like, yeah.
It was so lucky, like so, so lucky that we had already, because at that point, fitness studios were a big part of our strategy. I think early COVID, we had just signed a deal with SoulCycle to have our spray deodorant be in all their locker rooms. And so, you know, fitness studios were growing in importance to us. And I started to think about, okay, product pipeline, what else do we, you know, our customers love our aluminum free deodorant, but they are always raving about our scents and the fragrance, because that's really, I think, what's unique and to our products was this amazing fragrance that you literally want to wear on your whole body. And we'd have customers that were like, I want this as my perfume, like love these scents. So I was like, where else can we create magic with our fragrances? And so I remember going into SoulCycle and being like, oh, they have like Purell. And so we were going to make a nice fancy hand sanitizer for these fitness studios, because every fitness studio has hand sanitizer, and have it be in our signature scents. And so we had just started to work on a formula with a manufacturer. It was such crazy timing. Like, I think I connected with this manufacturer in like January of 2020. And so we were working on a formula, and we were planning to launch this in October. And so we weren't totally done. We didn't have any artwork. We didn't have bottles. I think we had just made, you know, our second pass at the formula. And then COVID started. And the founder of this lab, it was amazing and so scrappy and so awesome and loved me. And so I called her and I was like, Linda, like, can we make hand sanitizer now? Like, can we just, you know, how quickly, if we place a purchase order, can we make our hand sanitizer? And she was able to turn it around.
Wow.
I think I placed the purchase order third week of March, and we were able to launch it in May, which is a crazy turnaround.
Fast.
Insane.
Yes.
And the hardest part was getting the bottles. That was the biggest struggle. So I was staying up until like 4 in the morning calling manufacturers in China, like trying to find bottle manufacturers that had extra stock of like any bottle. I was like, as long as it's under like 4 ounces, we'll take it. And we, after 15 phone calls, I was able to find a manufacturer that had a customer that didn't pick up like 20,000 bottles.
Oh, interesting.
We took them, we air freighted them, we filled them, we launched our hand sanitizer. And like I said, that saved the business. We ended up reordering 15 times that quarter. And it was,
oh my gosh, it was crazy.
Hand sanitizer, like really.
At that time, yeah.
Saved us. We got into Nordstrom because of the hand sanitizer. It was crazy.
I'm going back a little bit, but we get a lot of questions on like, how do you find manufacturers? So this woman that you found seems amazing. I love that she's also a woman and you guys really connected. So like, how did you find her at that time?
This is one of the most common questions I get asked is like, how do you find manufacturers? It is, first of all, it's a small network. Like there's not that many cosmetic and personal care manufacturers. And we manufacture everything in the US. So especially just in the US, it's not like there's thousands of them. It's more like hundreds of them. So the first ones I found by just Googling, like I just Googled, you know, all natural deodorant manufacturers and found all the, you know, on the first 5 pages of Google, wrote, put them all in a spreadsheet and called them all or emailed them all. And that's how I've connected with my first, you know, batch. Most of them were too big and we're like, hey, we can't do, you know, a small batch, but hey, I know this person in Texas that can do that. Or I've got a buddy who's starting up or whatever. So it became like a networking. And that's really how we've met all the manufacturers we work with now is through networking. And you just get there. It's a very, very helpful, nice network of people. There's lots of conferences and stuff. So I'll go to Cosmoprof every year, which is in Vegas. They do it in Vegas and New York every year. All the manufacturers go to that. So you can meet new ones through that. And referrals, you know, sometimes I'll ask other companies or other brands. So I think networking has been the biggest unlock for finding great manufacturers. There's also this company called Pietra. For anyone that's like starting out, that we've
Pietra.
Used Pietra, they have this platform that you can search and put RFPs out for whether you want to make deodorant or whether you want to make sweatshirts or hats or candles. Like they have a network of tons of manufacturers, and you can put out an RFP to, you know, all of the manufacturers on their platform. So we've used them too for some products.
Yeah, I love that. And going back to even the initial thing you were saying when we started the interview about sharing your idea and your product, like that's exactly when we found our first manufacturer, exactly what you did. I did. Like I would call, they're like, you're too big. I'm like, is there anyone else that you know, right? That we could talk to? Just like dialing, calling everyone on Google, like you said, and sharing your idea. So it just goes back to like, when you put it out there, you will eventually find someone who's willing to help you. And it always works out at the end of the day, even though you might not see it starting out, but just putting your idea out there. But I love that. So tell me more. I don't know what year were you on Shark Tank? So like 2020, you launched this hand sanitizer. You guys are doing, you know, pretty well because of that. Tell me more about your Shark Tank story. Because when I heard the behind the scenes of how it happened, I was like, what? This is wild. So tell me everything.
I filmed in 2021. We aired in 2022. And that was, I would say, you know, our first big inflection point at Curie was QVC.
So that was before Shark Tank.
Yeah, I got onto QVC in 2021. And that was huge for us. And, you know, I'm still on QVC. I go on at least twice a month.
And how did you get in front of, was this like an outreach that you did for QVC? Like how did that partnership kind of come about?
Yeah, I actually auditioned. Like QVC has this like, what you call it, game show or program. It's called The Big Find. And small brands can come and pitch a panel of QVC hosts and they will pick, you know, 5 brands that get to go on QVC or HSN. And I did that and I didn't get picked. So there's the rejection. I was so upset. I flew all the way there and was crushed and like bawled the entire Uber back to the airport. And I was really, really disappointed. But through that, I made some relationships with, you know, QVC buyers and hosts. And so I just would follow up with them like every 3 months. I would send them an update on the business. Hey, we launched this product. Hey, we launched in Anthropology. Hey, this is what we're doing, you know, keeping them updated, keeping top of their inbox. And then it was just a timing thing. Like they were aluminum free deodorant was not at all on their radar. And all of a sudden it was, and they chose us to go on. So that was, I think it was just being persistent and reminding them that we're here. Yeah. So QVC was the first big inflection point. And then next thing that really put us on the map was Shark Tank. So Shark Tank, I filmed in 2021, and part of the story, if anyone hasn't seen the episode, you can watch it on YouTube. But spoiler alert, I was a stand-in for the season, meaning I had to prepare as though I was going on.
But I can't imagine.
I know, it was crazy. But I didn't actually have a time slot. So it was a long story. I actually had one and then I got canceled the night before. But again, rejection happens to the best of us. Got to power through. Got canceled the night before. And then they're like, you're just going to be on standby for the rest of the season. We'll call you if there's a time slot available for you to come film. And on like literally the last day of the filming window, I was on a hike, hungover on a Sunday. And the producer calls me and is like, can you be at the studio at 4 o'clock? Meanwhile, it's 1 o'clock and we're on the opposite side of LA. And I was like, sure. And so my husband and I just like floored it to our house. Like I quickly got ready. I didn't even shower. I literally put dry shampoo in my hair, did my makeup in the passenger seat of his car, got dropped at the studio, and boom, like got picked up in a golf cart and taken directly to the Shark Tank. It was crazy. And ended up getting a deal with Mark Cuban and Barbara Corcoran, which was so exciting and just shocking. And it has really like fundamentally changed my business. Shark Tank has been the biggest needle mover for us by far.
Oh my gosh, I have a million questions. That is amazing. I mean, you're
such a ridiculous story. Like people don't believe it. And I tell the story on the show. I'm like, I was hiking 3 hours ago and the producers called me. And there's all these comments on the YouTube video where people are like, she's lying. There's no way. Why would she be hiking before she goes on Shark Tank? I'm like, I know this sounds made up, but it's 100% true. I have receipts. I have photos from that hike.
Oh my God. I'm glad you brought that up because it shows just like your ability to like show up, perform, get shit done like that. Not a lot of people can do that. And that's pretty amazing because wow, that's wild. Because I know I've had a few women on the podcast who have been on Shark Tank and they're like, listen, it took me like weeks of prep, right? It's not, I don't know how much time you put, but I know it's like no joke. So to be on standby, like
it was a lot of work, hours and hours. Like preparing for Shark Tank was like a part-time job. Like they really make you do a lot of prep.
So are they working with you?
Yes. Yeah. The producers work with you. You have a weekly call and you have to write your own pitch. You have to prepare all your Q&A. You have to design your set. You have to buy your set. You have to get it delivered. Like it's a lot of work. They're not helping with that much of it. So it was a lot of work with no guarantee. It was scary, but I knew how big the opportunity was. So I did it and luckily it paid off. I joke that like I prepared for Shark Tank like I was an athlete going to the Olympics. I put so much time and energy into it. It was a lot. But I will say in hindsight, the way that it worked out where, because most people I know that went on Shark Tank, you go show up at 6 a.m. and you have to sit in a trailer for like up to 10 hours waiting to get called. And that was going to be me when I had a scheduled filming time. My call time was 6:30 and I was going to have to just sit in the trailer until they decided it was my turn. And the way that it happened was actually so much better for me because I would have gotten so nervous, so in my head. And by the time I went out there, I would have been like shaky and nervous out of my mind. But the way it happened, I didn't have time to be nervous. I was like my adrenaline was through the roof.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, I could have run through walls. Like I was on one when I went on to that set, because I was just like, oh my God, like what had just happened was so crazy. And you can see in the episode, my energy was just shooting out of my ears, because I was just pure adrenaline at that point, and I did not have 1 second to get nervous.
I haven't watched the episode in a while, but I don't remember you being like so amped. You were still calm, because sometimes when I'm in that mode, like I talk fast, like I'm on like another level. Sometimes I'm like, I don't know where I go. I'm like in the ether, but you were still like pretty calm and you looked grounded. But
I would say because you're in there for an hour.
So, I was going to ask how long.
Yeah,
it was.
I was in there for a full hour, so I calmed down as time went by. But yeah, I was pretty hyped up at the beginning.
Oh my gosh, it was funny. I had she's so sweet, Lindsay McCormick. She's a founder of Byte. Yeah, she was on Shark. Yeah, she's amazing. And I think it was her where she was saying, I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't making any crazy faces, because I know they take the cuts and put it like on something else. I'm like, oh my gosh, I never would have even thought about that. That's brilliant. So
see, it was so long, like an hour is a long time. And so I kind of, the moments, I kind of forgot there was cameras.
Sure. I would imagine.
Yeah. And so afterwards I was like, shoot, did I do anything embarrassing that they're going to put on there? Like I had no idea. Well, I could barely even remember, but an hour is a long time to be like on and camera ready.
Yes.
It was like a marathon.
Ready.
Yeah.
Obviously we don't see everything, but like the Q&A, was it majority of you speaking? Like how long are pitches typically, and how much is Q&A? I'm always curious about
the pitch is like 3 minutes. You write it, you memorize it, it's dialed, they make it a certain amount of time. So I think mine was like 2.5 or 3 minutes. So the pitch was like, you know, 1%. It was mostly the Q&A. And the Q&A is like really overwhelming. And I had talked to people like Lindsay before I went on the show. I knew a few people, Natalie from Bala. I had a few friends that had been on the show and they kind of warned me. But it was really intense. Like all the sharks they're intense people. They have questions and they want to ask them. And so they're all asking at the same time and just peppering you and interrupting each other. And so I talked to someone that I had talked to that had been on the show before. And they were like, you have to like command the room and they'll respect you for doing that. Like, don't let them control what's happening. Like it's your job to be the moderator. And so I did that a lot. Like I'd be like, Lori, great question. I'm going to answer Mark's question first and then I'll get back to you, rather than being like, like flustered. I just tried to like treat them like my, you know, a kindergarten classroom. Like, I know you all have questions.
Great tip.
One at a time, please, you know? And I would be like very controlled and methodical about it. Great question. I'll get back to you on that. Let me finish this and da 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 da, which I think does make them respect you a lot.
That's great advice. I love that. And were there any questions where you were not sure how to approach it in any sense?
No. Oh my God. No. I prepared like a crazy person. My husband and I spent weeks every night. We would sit down.
That.
He would sit down on the couch and he would pretend to be sharks. And he, you know, we watched enough Shark Tank where he knew all the personalities and would pretend to be Mr. Wonderful being a jerk, or like pretend to be Lori asking about QVC. And he would ask me every question you could ever imagine. I made a spreadsheet of all the possible questions. There was no question that caught me off guard.
I love that. And it's so good to talk about the behind the scenes, because I think people kind of look at entrepreneurs, or even look at you on Shark Tank, they're like, how does she know all that? It's like, oh, there's a lot of work that you put behind the scenes. And that's also business, right? Like people are like, oh, like they just show up and, you know, you're in SoulCycle and QVC. It's like, there's actually so much prep work that no one sees. Maybe your partner and best friends and family, like people think it's very glamorous. I'm like, there's a lot of invisible work that goes on that people don't realize. So I love that you just kind of shared that.
And it helped that it's my business and I'm in it every single day. Like it was maybe impressive on the outside watching how I responded to questions and quick responses, doing quick math. And people, you know, I'll look at the comments on YouTube and I'm like, yeah, it seems impressive, but like it is part of me. Like Curie is my baby. I know everything. And there's no question that they could ask. That's like if you did a personal interview, like there's no question someone could ask you that you don't know about yourself. Like it is different when you're doing a Q&A for your own business than, you know, some other
like
subject.
Job or something. Yeah.
Yeah. That is or like true. Your job or like another, some subject that maybe you don't know everything, but I'm like, this is my business. There's nothing I can't answer.
I love that. So tell me more about, because, you know, we didn't talk about if you fundraise, but you put 12K in the beginning before Shark Tank. Did you raise any money? Like, how did you think about,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So bootstrapped the business, $12,000 in my savings at the beginning. And then when I quit my job, I did go out and raise some outside funding. Overall, you know, we've raised around $1 million. We haven't gone out and raised institutional capital, mostly angel investors, small family offices. And that really helped hire a team and get us in a good position to scale.
Got it. Yeah. Cause I know Shark Tank, I mean, you talk to like investors, you know, they talk about on the show, like a solid amount of equity, right? But obviously like who they are and everything. So
we also have a line of credit, which is huge. I think any business that's, you know, doing over a couple $1 million in revenue should go out and get a line of credit, especially a product business that has working capital needs like ours, because that, you know, we got into 4,000 Walmart doors last year and, you know, the business grew 600%. So like I could not have possibly sustained that level of growth and a full chain Walmart launch without that line of credit, because if you have a product like ours, you have to manufacture it months before it goes into stores or goes, you know, gets sold to a customer, and you got to float that cash. And so the line of credit has been like instrumental to our success and like ability to grow quickly.
That's incredible. And I know, you know, you mentioned QVC was big inflection point. Shark Tank was huge. I know the behind the scenes of that also was tough in terms of you guys were selling out, going on pre-orders. Like, yeah, that's amazing. But like operationally, I'm sure it was a lot, like a lot of people reaching out. So did that experience kind of set you up to think a little bit more about scale, which, you know, obviously now you're in Walmart. So was that a little bit easier of a transition for you?
No,
or it's different.
It's so hard. It's all hard. Every step in the business is hard. I mean, I remember in the early days, right after I launched, I reached out to Priscilla from Coco Kind. You know that brand?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. She lived in San Francisco. I started the business in San Francisco and I reached out to her on Instagram and we got coffee. And she was a few years ahead of us. And I remember her being like, this is the fun part. Like, just enjoy it. Because as you grow, as you make more, like more money, more problems, like as the business grows, your problems are just going to get bigger and scarier and less fun. And that is so true. Like, you've never made it. Like, even when we hit our blow through our forecasts and things are doing amazing, like, all it does is bring more new problems to solve. And that's like never, ever going to change. I don't think it's ever going to be easy at any point.
Yeah. It's so funny. I threw like this poker event and had women founders come and all of them were asking like, oh, how's BM, my business doing? And they all said the same thing. I had four separate entrepreneurs who meant, you know, they're having like at least 50 million plus businesses. They're like, you are in the best phase, like enjoy it. And really like hearing that from so many people, I was like, all right, Yasmin, your problems are really nothing compared to what comes as you grow. So it's good perspective.
So true. I like think back at the problems that like would keep me up at night or that I would be like, oh, we're going to go out of business. And I'm like, I laugh. Like that is like, if that happened now, I would be like, oh, move on, like whatever. But at the time they felt so existential. It's just, you definitely grow a thicker skin as you go.
I'm like, those little things don't faze me, but then you always elevate to a new level where you're growing and figuring it out. So you're always getting challenged in the next phase of the business. But no, I would love to just maybe end on one thing. You know, you've kind of like a theme. A lot of what we talked about is the challenges. And I love talking about this because it's reality of what happens behind the scenes. But how do you kind of manage your mental health, your joy? Because I know sometimes it could be all encompassing where you can easily burn out, right? So how have you kind of laid the platform for yourself for like longevity and enjoying the process? Because that's also like a huge part of it, right? It's just staying in the game, which is not easy.
Not dying. I know.
Not dying. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's just, it's just like not in my nature to be a workaholic.
That's amazing.
It's just never been me. I have a really good balance, I think, in my life. And I think it's just has come really naturally to me. I know that I need breaks and I know how beneficial prioritizing my health. I work out every day. I usually log off at like by 5 o'clock every day. And I'm not like burning the midnight oil. My husband and I have dinner together. We, you know, watch shows together. Like I would not classify myself as like a workaholic. I think also I love that the culture is changing around that too, with the old like Gary Vee hustle mentality is like kind of dead. People are realizing like that's maybe will work for a short period of time. And I do work in sprints. Like if we have something, you know, Walmart launch, new product launches, like I am buckled down and I'm working my butt off, but that's not sustainable for me. And especially being in my 30s, I'm just like, I'm tired. I don't want to work past 10 o'clock at night. So I do think I like have a pretty good balance. I prioritize my fitness. I eat well. I sleep. I don't let my work cut into my sleeping hours. I go on vacation. So, you know, sometimes I'll take a Friday off and go hang out with my nieces and nephews. Like I don't think that that's like ever been an issue. And I think that I've built that into the company really since day one.
That's incredible. I'm so inspired, Sarah. That's amazing. I mean, I had to learn the hard way. I feel like being in finance, my body has learned to just sit and work. But when you're starting your own business, like that doesn't equal success. It's like,
no, it does the opposite. Yeah. 100%. I think, seriously, like I went on a vacation. My first like vacation since starting the business was in 2020. And my husband and I, and it was the first time I'd had employees. So I was like, oh my God, I can go on vacation and you guys can do everything. Like, awesome. And it was so scary, but we took, I think, like a week off and I like fully unplugged and just trusted everyone to get stuff done. And I came back with like a million new ideas, so many new ideas. While I was gone, we had gotten a purchase order from Nordstrom, like our first purchase order from Nordstrom. And I came back just like full of energy and ideas. And I've just made sure to like prioritize that. I go on a couple vacations a year. And I think also just take time off periodically when I need it, go do a spa day on a Tuesday. And it really helps me like recharge and think creatively again.
No, I love it. Well, Sarah, I know we went a little few minutes over, but it was so amazing to see you. Love the success.
Thank you.
I can't wait to continue to see it, but thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. This is really fun and great catching up with you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Behind Her Empire. If you enjoyed this conversation, it would mean the world to me if you would consider leaving a review or even sharing this episode with someone who might be inspired to create their own empire. To stay updated on new episodes or join our private community, visit behindherempire.com to sign up. We send inspiring and short emails every week to your inbox. I'll see you next week. And until then, remember, you're always in charge of your own destiny, and it's never too late to start your own empire.